Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Kevin Williamson of National Review Online in for Jim Garrity today. And you and I can both testify that we were scouring the pages for good news today, and there wasn't much to be found, but we did find one that's very interesting and hopefully trends pretty well. And that's a situation that some folks have been following very closely in the Netherlands. Others may not know much about it. And that's the story of Geert Wilders, who is a Dutch politician. He's considered a right-wing politician, but what he's most famous for is being pretty frank in what he sees as the threat to his country, the Netherlands, by a massive influx of Muslim immigration, particularly the radical threat posed to his country. He's basically been made a pariah, or at least many have attempted to make him a pariah. But he got good news today that he's been acquitted on hate speech charges simply by offering his thoughts on the Muslim immigration debate in his country. So at a time when it's so politically incorrect to say anything that's mildly critical of Muslims, even radical Muslims in this country, it's good to see that the PC hub of the world, Western Europe, is actually heading in the right direction, at least on one story.
I really like the Netherlands, and I like the Dutch people, and I'm going to miss them when they're gone. But you know, Wilders was charged because he wrote a newspaper editorial and made a movie. I mean, this guy was being accused of thought crimes, essentially, for criticizing Islam, for saying that the Quran had passages in it which were fascistic, and for calling upon Muslims to symbolically rip those passages out and reject the idea of violence in the name of religion. You know, they paint him as a big-time right-winger. He's about as right-wing, maybe, as John Huntsman. Probably not even that right-wing. I mean, which makes him crazy right-wing by Dutch standards, of course. It's hard for us to understand, I think, as Americans, because we take, you know, the First Amendment so for granted. But, you know, National Review's Mark Stein was charged with a similar thought crimes in Canada, human rights violations, they called them. It happens in places. And I can almost get it in places like Germany with their laws about using Nazi imagery and things like that. I think for the Germans, maybe that's fine. But to put a Dutch politician whose party is now part of the government, of course, they're a minority partner in the government, on trial for speaking his mind on one of the important public issues of his day, which he also happens to be right about, is just insane. But it's nice that he's gotten off, although the bad news is that he was ever, you know, charged in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely right. And it kind of dovetails well into what we've seen in at least a couple times already this year on Capitol Hill when Peter King, the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, has tried to simply hold hearings on the radicalization of Muslims in this country. And you would think that he's out there with torches and pitchforks and internment camps lined up for these people. And all he's trying to do is understand how folks get radicalized in the prisons and the mosques and elsewhere. And all he gets is a bunch of grief and very little support, I think, although I think the majority of Americans like what he's doing, but he probably doesn't hear as much from them as he does from the rabid folks foaming at the mouth on the left who think that somehow he's being a massive bigot.
If he's really that interested in radicalization, I really think he ought to ask his IRA buddies about that because they're the real experts. Why does it have to be him holding those hearings?
That's a good question.
What a jerk.
Yeah, that's true. He doesn't exactly have the most sanitized past when it comes to supporting the right side when it comes to terrorism. But
no, I don't think so.
On to number two now. And speaking of terrorism, there is a war against it. At least that's the way it's been termed over the past decade. But last night, the President of the United States very happily told us that, without actually mentioning that we've really achieved our goals, we're about to leave Afghanistan in phases. 10,000 troops this year, 33,000 by next summer, everything out by 2014. A lot of different vague issues that he brought up, that we're achieving goals, we've taken some strongholds. The Afghan security forces, which apparently he's the only one who thinks they're coming along well. He's defying the recommendations of David Petraeus. And here's just a little snippet of what the president had to say last night.
We've ended our combat mission in Iraq with 100,000 American troops already out of that country. And even as there will be dark days ahead in Afghanistan, the light of a secure peace can be seen in the distance. These long wars will come to a responsible end.
Apparently responsible end is Obama ease for absolute victory, like FDR promised back in World War II. A couple other things.
He even used the light at the end of the tunnel sort of metaphor there, like LBJ.
Yeah, exactly right. Just a couple other things that I found fascinating in there, and that's that he mentioned at least three times, if not more, that Osama bin Laden is dead, in case some folks had missed that. I think that's going to be the platform for his reelection campaign, because that's really the only thing that I think that's been accomplished here. It was interesting that when Obama announced the death of bin Laden less than 2 months ago, he said that that did not mean that that was the end of hostilities. Well, apparently, I guess it does.
Yeah. You know, have you ever noticed how all of Obama's deadlines are around 2014? You know, nothing ever happens before 2012. You know, Obamacare doesn't kick in until after the election. We don't really figure out what we're going to do in Afghanistan until after the election. His whole, you know, closed Gitmo thing, that's going to happen around 2045, something like that. I disagree with a lot of my fellow conservatives on this. I really take more of Andy McCarthy's view that, okay, Obama doesn't know what we're doing in Afghanistan. This is true. He doesn't have much of a plan. He doesn't seem to have any sort of definition of victory. But the country doesn't really either. I mean, we went to Afghanistan to kick the tar out of the Taliban and go after al-Qaeda. Well, we did that, and it's done. This nation-building stuff, I like George Bush a lot better before he was a nation-building guy. I really think that the U.S. foreign policy should look something like, we draw a little line in the sand, you guys stay on that side, we're going to stay on this side, but if you get on our side, it's going to be scorched earth, and we're not going to rebuild your crappy little countries. I mean, Afghanistan is never going to be a normal country. He says there's, you know, a reasonable peace within sight. No, there is not. Not in the next 500 years, there isn't. You know, the idea that we're going to turn Afghanistan into a liberal democracy is even more absurd than the idea we're going to turn Iraq into one. As I say, you can bomb your enemies into the Stone Age, but you can't bomb them into the 21st century.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the things he alluded to, which I hope will be true, and that's that the radical elements of the Taliban can't return to power and can't provide a safe haven for the terrorist groups, because that's the one thing that we absolutely want to make sure doesn't happen again. Like you said, trying to establish a government there that's not corrupt and is somewhere relatively close to a modern nation is something that's going to be very elusive for a very long time there. So
yeah, I mean, Karzai might be the best we're going to do. Just kind of like, you know, we all sort of hated Musharraf. I mean, he was, you know, he was a strong man, military general, dictator, playing both sides of the fence. But you know what? He's the best we're probably ever going to see in Pakistan.
Yeah.
He's going to look like Madison compared to to what comes after. And, you know, Karzai very well may go down as Afghanistan's greatest liberal political leader. I mean, granted, there's not a lot of competition on that front, but he may end up being the best we've ever done. And as much as we hate him, as corrupt, double-dealing, backward, thieving character as he is, wait and see what comes next.
Yeah, exactly. I love the sliding.
But in terms of preventing, you know, the safe havens and all that, I mean, that's why we've got special forces and drones and intelligence and all that. I mean, we ought to be, you know, tearing around the world chasing these guys wherever they are anyway. If they're in France, we should be in France. If they're in a hotel room in Utah, we should be in the hotel room in Utah. There should be no safe place on this earth for those guys. We should be no respecter of borders or anything else. But trying to, you know, even if we did succeed in building Afghanistan and turning it into Connecticut, they're just going to go to Pakistan. They're going to go to Yemen. They're going to go to wherever. We can't do the whole world.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, on to martini number three now. And, Kevin, I'll defer to your wisdom here for the most part, since you're much more of an economic wizard on this than I am. But after much consideration, the Obama administration has apparently decided to tap the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which has several hundred million barrels of oil in it. They're going to tap about 30 million in order to help alleviate the pain at the pump and so forth. As a layman here on this sort of thing, Kevin, it seems like this, once again, kind of like the Afghan policy, is time to be very political in nature, because given the fact that we consume about 20 million barrels a day, the impact of this doesn't seem to be real long term.
No, you know, there's a lot of competition for dumbest economic policy of the Obama administration, but this may be a contender. You know, it's up there. The thing about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is it's for emergencies. It's for if we happen to be in a war and the sea lanes get cut off and we lose our oil supplies because Canada disappears or whatever. $4 gas is a national crisis, but it's a national crisis for Barack Obama and his reelection hopes. That's the only people it's an emergency for. The thing about Obama that really drives me crazy on this is he's all into the, you know, green energy, alternative fuels, and all that sort of stuff. Well, if you want to let those things be effective, if you want to make them economically viable, then you let the price of gasoline go up to what it's going to go up to. But of course, if gas hits $5 a gallon in, say, October of next year, he's toast. And he knows that. And he is totally off the market. I mean, the truth is that supply for oil is limited. You know, it's growing still, but it's growing at a limited pace. Demand for it is going to continue to grow probably much more quickly with China, India becoming wealthier. Not only energy consumption, but other oil-related things like fertilizer, plastics, all that kind of stuff. The price of gasoline is going to go up probably for the next, I don't know, 20 years. Who knows? But people really respond to gas prices because, you know, it's just one of this sort of strange emotional thing because Americans have this weird connection with our cars. And even though, you know, when gas goes from $3.45 to $3.55 or $3.65 or whatever, it's not really that big a deal for your average American household. But it's just maddening because it's out of pocket and we feel like, you know, we're getting gouged, even though it's just natural, you know, supply and demand. And yeah, it's not going to make a blip on the price. It's coals to Newcastle. You know, there's a lot of oil out there on the market.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think while 365 is certainly, you know, better than it is in most other countries, for folks who can remember when it was certainly down in the $2 range, if not even below a buck, not too long ago, it certainly is a major difference, especially for spending a lot of time on the road. So we'll see where that price is exactly in October of next year, because like you said, it's going to make a huge difference potentially on who wins that election. So, Kevin, great having you with us this week. We'll talk to you later.
Always a pleasure.
Kevin Williamson of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us tomorrow for the next 3 Martini Lunch.